from deep inside your radio.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, we tried to have a ticker tape parade, but we couldn't get the damn stuff to march. It just stuck to the ground. Anyway, that's all about the fact that this program, after an absence of some decades, is back on the air in New York City on WNYC AM. That's right. It's the 21st century, and I'm proud to be on AM radio. I'm proud of it. Analog AM. So welcome back, WNYC. Welcome back, New York City. I give me 3 months. This is sort of an auspicious little period of time. Just a month ago, we welcomed WWNO in New Orleans to the network. So New Orleans, New York, what's next? New Haven? I don't know. But it's new. Whatever it is, it's new. This is an auspicious week, ladies and gentlemen, in my business, the show business. We all stood a little prouder, I think, when Woody Allen put his name on that petition for Roman Polanski. You know, that made me feel proud to be in the business. And at the end of the week, David Letterman answered a question I think we've all had on our minds for some time. Why do they call it Worldwide Pants? So it's a big week, but there's big news on the U.S.-Iran front. And in that regard, one of the regular features of this broadcast, as people outside New York know, is the buried lead department, where I attempt to point out that, the story may have had the wrong thing at the top. So in the New York Times on Saturday, there was a big story about, in August, a public report to the board of the IAEA by its staff concluded that the evidence of Iran's alleged military activity was probably genuine that on the nuclear front, although the IAEA today has criticized that story. But anyway, that's what's up in the lead, in the top. Now we get way down to the bottom. The IAEA's tentative analysis, according to the New York Times, says that Iran most likely obtained the needed information for designing and building an implosion bomb, quote, from external sources, unquote. It said nothing specific about the external sources. Any guesses, folks? Hands? Many intelligence agencies, according to the New York Times, assume that Iran obtained a bomb design from A.Q. Khan, the rogue Pakistani black marketer who sold it machines to enrich uranium. So we're all head up about Iran maybe having this information and threatening all sorts of stuff. And where is A.Q. Khan? Mowing the lawn. Was under house arrest. Now he's free. Because we care so much about nuclear proliferation. We've never even been able to talk to him. The Pakistanis said, no, we'll do the debriefing. Thanks. Thanks just the same. Ladies and gentlemen, it's clean, it's safe, it's too cheap to meter. It's nuclear energy. Speaking of which. Dateline South Haven, Michigan. In the 24 years in the pharmacy business, Randy Davis has never before stocked potassium iodide, but this week some 16,000 doses of it came into his pharmacy. Says Davis, I don't have 16,000 doses of anything. I can fix that, Randy. The drug was sent by the state of Michigan for distribution to residents living within 10 miles of the Palisades nuclear power plant. And it's free. The pharmacies, among a handful of pharmacies near nuclear power plants, the others in Benton Harbor, Monroe, Woodhaven, and Michigan City, Indiana, that received stocks of potassium iodide tablets last week. They're intended, these pills, to be taken within 4 hours of a severe nuclear accident. What are you thinking? They don't happen. We don't have those. And they work by filling the thyroid with stable iodine, thus blocking the absorption of radioactive iodine. Residents living within 10 miles of the Palisades nuclear power plant, along the Lake Michigan shoreline. Nobody gets their drinking water from there, do they? Should have received vouchers in the mail from the state of Michigan for the potassium iodide, packaged in a 20-pill box. That leopard skin 20-pill box. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission announced in 2002 it would offer potassium iodide free to 34 states that have nuclear plants. Various factors have slowed the program's implementation in Michigan till now. Various factors. We'll look those up. Palisades nuclear plant has been here for 40 years, says the pharmacist, Mr. Davis. We're only now beginning to be concerned about it. I scratch my head and say, why? Okay. I scratch my head and say, why not? Bobby Kennedy, wasn't it? And, ladies and gentlemen, you know, we know that there's a lot of bad stuff connected with an economic downturn. But this week comes a report that maybe we're healthier. Researchers have found that historically Americans were healthier during the Great Depression and other economic downturns than they were during periods of prosperity. And they say the trend may hold true today. And a research team found an inverse association between economic health and population health. Life expectancy fell during economic upturns, increased during recessions. Deaths related to flu and pneumonia fell from about 150 per 100,000 in 1929 to roughly 100 per the next year. This is in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Suicide, the only cause of death that increased during times of economic turmoil. Life expectancy, the patterns were particularly obvious among non-whites. Between 21 and 26, a period of startling economic growth, life expectancy declined 8.1 years among non-white males, 7.4 among non-white females. During the Depression, life expectancy among non-whites increased by 8 years. Speculation as to why? Economic booms are associated with more smoking and drinking, less sleep, more work-related stress. Traffic-related deaths and industrial injuries increase during periods of economic growth. And a researcher speculates another factor may involve social support. Recessions tend to bring people together. I'll see you later tonight at your house. Hello, welcome to the show. From the edge of America, from the home of the homeless, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. And while Santa Monica, the city from which this program, whence this program emanates, may be the home of the homeless, just shortly to the east of us, it's not so good, according to Affordable Housing Finance magazine. Yeah, the kid threw it in the fountain today. Los Angeles is the meanest city in America when it comes to treatment of the homeless, according to a new report by the National Law Center on Homelessness and Poverty. The ranking is based on several factors, including the number of laws targeted at the homeless, the enforcement of those laws, and the general public climate toward homeless people. See? I'm pointing at you, Angelinos. The report cites a UCLA study. Well, what do they know? That found the city was spending $6 million a year to pay for 50 extra police officers to crack down on crime in Skid Row. Only 5.7 is budgeted for homeless services. Well, it's a service to move you from Skid Row. That's a service. It's not a product. Los Angeles officials call the report misleading. It fails to deal with the city's Housing First strategy, which reflects national best practices for housing and services that help homeless individuals stay off the streets, says a statement from the mayor. Best practices. I think that's the cliche of this decade so far. Let's do best practices, shall we? Then you can't possibly criticize us. It's best practices, babe. What's your problem? And now, ladies and gentlemen, news from outside the bubble. From the Code of Radio Best Practices, from the Sunday Telegraph of London. The president of Iran, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, is revealed to have Jewish roots. The paper has a photograph of the Iranian president holding up his identity card during the 2008 elections, clearly showing his family has Jewish roots. He was previously known, his family name was previously Saburgian, a Jewish name meaning cloth weaver. The short note scrawled on the card suggests his family changed its name to Ahmadinejad when they converted to embrace Islam after his birth. The Saburgians traditionally hail from Aradan, Ahmadinejad's birthplace, and the name arrives from Weaver of the Sabur, the name for the Jewish prayer shawl in Persia. The name is even on the list of reserved names for Iranian Jews compiled by Iran's Ministry of the Interior. Experts in London suggested Mr. Ahmadinejad's track record for hate-filled attacks on Jews could be an overcompensation to hide his past. A London-based expert on Iranian Jewry said that the Jian, J-I-A-N, ending to the name specifically showed the family had been practicing Jews. Spokesman for the Israeli embassy in London said it would not comment on the president's background. It's not something we'd talk about, says Ron Gador. Closing Gador. The Iranian leader has not denied his name was changed when his family moved to Tehran in the 1950s, but he has never revealed what it was changed from or directly addressed the reason for the switch. All I can say is watching him in his recent press conference, it all makes sense, because many times he'd be asked a question, he answered with a question. And wait, there's more from outside the bubble. This from Business Management Daily. So many employees of the Fox Kalamansky advertising agency in London were taking leave for beauty treatments that the agency added an extra paid day off. Executives there call it Botox leave. We've heard rumors this is what people do with this day, says managing director Stephen Fox. most others get haircuts or facials instead. It's up to each employee. The day off happens in December, says Fox, who speculates employees need time to make sure they're looking their best for Christmas. Cosmetic surgeons at Britain's Harley Medical Group say they expect other companies to follow suit as more employees sign up for Botox and employers discourage them from using regular sick leave to pay for it. It's a Botox day. I see a new Bill Murray movie where they keep having the same injection. No, that's real. The drug company that makes Botox spent almost $1 million entertaining and educating doctors and nurses about its products in Australia alone. Well, they weren't alone. In the first 6 months of this year, hundreds of doctors and nurses were put up in five-star hotels and treated to meals at fancy restaurants as the drug company sponsored medical conferences and ran injector training days. It's a different kind of Botox day. The huge amount spent promoting the product to doctors is in the latest Medicines Australia report. The nation's 39 drug companies spent more than $31 million on 16,000 dinners and functions for doctors and nurses in the first 6 months of the year. 15 million of the amount went on food and drink and hotels. Only 72,000 medical practitioners in Australia. Critics claim these functions influence doctors' prescribing habits. Drug companies claim they're about educating doctors on the latest research. The Cosmetic Physicians Society of Australia said $300 million a year was being spent on non-surgical procedures. The industry was growing at a rate of 30%. Botox is now the most requested treatment in 91% of clinics. General practitioners giving tips on how to use the product at these training courses are hosting Botox parties for patients with lucky door prizes donated by cosmetic surgery companies. Complaints have been made about nurses illegally administering the prescription-only drug in beauty salons and at Botox parties. I don't know. Maybe real. They may be real. Maybe like gumbo parties were in Kayville. Remember that? I know people in New Orleans do. But Botox parties? Really? You think? Okay. But still, wait. More news from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen. Something you probably haven't heard of either. From the BBC, a new 10-minute video has been posted on the social networking site Facebook in which Pakistani soldiers are seen apparently abusing Taliban suspects. Hearts and minds, babe. Hearts and... The video would be the first clear proof of such abuse. It shows men in military uniform beating suspects as officers stand by giving instructions. It's not clear who shot the film or where. It appears to have been made recently, perhaps in the Swat Valley, which of course answers the question, why do you think they call it? Pakistan's army has said it needs to examine the video before commenting and to send it to AQ Khan. For conversations heard on the video suggest it is recent. Troops recently declared they had largely cleared the Swat Valley of insurgents. Human rights groups have accused the military of being involved in torture and extrajudicial killings in the region. This is a very serious accusation, says General Athar Abbas, head of Pakistan Army's public relations wing. There's a busy man. I cannot comment on the video until you've examined it. This will take some time, as the Army headquarters will have to be involved in the process. I bet. The footage shows an officer in a Pakistan Army battle uniform interrogating several suspects, some of whom are quite elderly and presumably relatives of men being sought. When the officer does not receive satisfactory answers, he motions with his head, and soldiers rush in to punish the subject. Bad apples. They're Pakistani bad apples. What do you want? They then beat him with belts, fists, and what appear to be small whips. Well, you know, bad apples can buy whips at the bad apple store. He is also kicked all over the body by soldiers wearing heavy army boots. The suspect is heard screaming and imploring the soldiers to stop in the name of Allah, repeatedly saying he has told them all he knows. In the video, the soldiers administering the beating have to be restrained by the officer on at least two occasions. Boys, we're on Facebook. Easy. After an initial round of punishment, the officer tells the suspect that this is soft treatment. Unless the suspect tells all, the officer says he will have to administer hard punishment. You don't want me to cut off your hands and feet, the officer says. Now that's a joke. Nobody... Yeah, they do. If confirmed, this would be the first clear proof of the Pakistani army being involved in the abuse of detainees. Pakistan's Human Rights Commission and other groups have accused the army of such violations during the SWAT campaign. Pakistani army says we'll investigate if any solid proof emerges of its personnel being involved in some activities. And those, you know, will be good investigations, because I believe in the Pakistani army and its ability to inspect and investigate. Don't ask me why. It's just a thing. It's just a thing I have. Maybe it's because, you know, they did such a good job interrogating AQ Khan while he was at home. And now, ladies and gentlemen, another copyrighted feature of this broadcast.
He's not a general. He commands no troops. He's not an inspector. He peeks at no stoops. He's an inspector general. Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. News from the inspectors general. Because they find out stuff that we don't know. The FBI's Weapons of Mass Destruction Unit, it's tasked with tracking threats from weapons of mass destruction, suffers from several operational problems, according to the Justice Department's Inspector General. This is 1 week after federal authorities charged three people with WMD-related offenses. Inspector General Glenn Fine reported that many inside the FBI's WMD Coordinator Program were not able to identify the top specific WMD threats and vulnerabilities that face their particular division. It said the audit FBI has not established adequate training programs to educate its analysts on the subject, nor has it established specific qualifications that WMD coordinators should have. I could do it, I guess, is what he's saying. I qualify. Inspector General's audit noted continuing problems with coordination between the FBI's WMD unit and other divisions. The coordinators were not directly involved in WMD threat assessments used by field offices. As a result, the audit concluded the FBI's WMD threat assessments may not be complete. It said FBI field offices have not been able to identify the most significant WMD threats in their regions, in large part because WMD coordinators have had limited interaction with the field intelligence groups. You guys are still not talking to each other. Can you get Skype, please? Not a plug. And the office of in charge of auditing Pentagon contracts is beset by, any guesses? Incompetence and possibly malfeasance that has allowed big defense contractors to line their pockets at taxpayer expense, according to two new government oversight reports. The Defense Contract Audit Agency, obscure but important, looked at $501 billion in contractor costs, but it isn't doing the job so well, concludes the Defense Department's Inspector General. But, you know, that's just defense contracts. One auditor told the GAO, which also made a report on the subject, he did not perform detailed tests because, quote, the contractor would not appreciate it, unquote. Well, you know. Depends who your client is, I guess. And as the White House raised the request from the top U.S. commander for additional troops in Afghanistan, a new report from the Defense Department's Inspector General attributes shortcomings in the Afghan army and police forces to a shortage of U.S. mentors and trainers, as well as corruption and illiteracy among Afghan soldiers, and a lack of strategic planning. Aside from that, Mrs. Lincoln, it's fine. Expansion of the Afghan National Security Forces beyond currently approved levels will face major challenges, says the report, listing a major one as, quote, the time necessary to develop ethical, competent leaders. I think we're facing that same problem closer to home. Not all the report is negative. The Inspector General does find that Afghan Army units have demonstrated consistently that they will fight. Okay, good. They don't run. They don't flee. It's a step forward. It says it will take at least another year before the security forces will be able to demonstrate measurable progress. The Inspector General reports the Afghan army leaders are manipulating a new electronic pay system to extort soldiers' pay. Afghan officers or NCOs take soldiers' ID cards when they leave posts to give their money to relatives or banks and then require them to pay to get the cards back. An American officer reported in his area there was no system for holding Afghan soldiers accountable for their weapons, uniforms, vehicles, or other equipment. Another U.S. mentor said in his area only about 80 or 90 units of a 100-unit supply order got through to the Afghan company. 300% of the necessary cold weather gear had to be ordered with no explanation for the duplication and no consequences to anyone for the loss and or theft of the gear. Officers in Kabul reported that fuel was a systematic problem, in the National Police Force, with corruption and hoarding leading to patrols being curtailed because of lack of fuel. The Inspector General described shortages of U.S. trainers and mentors at almost every level of the Afghan operation. Expansion of the current teams, the liaison teams, beyond the currently approved ceilings will require additional U.S. personnel resources, i.e., send more troops. And teach them to read. News from Inspectors General, ladies and gentlemen. A copyrighted feature of this broadcast.
I used to know you when we were young. You were in all my dreams. We sat together in period one, Fridays at 8:15. Now I see your face in the strangest places, movies and magazines. I saw you talking to Christopher Walken on my TV screen. But I will wait for you as long as I need to. And if you ever get back to Pack and Sack, I'll be here for you. I used to work in a record store. Now I work for my dad, scraping the paint off of hardwood floors. The hours are pretty bad. Sometimes I wonder where you are. Probably in LA. That seems to be where everybody else ends up. I'll be here for you.
This is Le Show, and now, ladies and gentlemen, no, we're not rubbing it in, Chicago. Count your blessings. News of the Olympic movement. Not what you think. From the London Times, the burqa boxers are coming. Young women are training in Afghanistan to fight in Islamic dress at the 2012 London Olympics. That's worth $12 million, isn't it? Or pounds, whatever you're spending. Wearing hijabs beneath their head guards and clothes that cover their bodies, 25 female pugilists, or feejilists, are preparing for their bouts and grueling training sessions at Kabul's Olympic Stadium. Kabul has an Olympic Stadium? Once the scene of public executions by the Taliban. The team were recruited by their coach, Fadir Sharafi, a former professional boxer. He persuaded the girls' families it would not be inappropriate for them to take to the ring. The 2012 Summer Games will be the first time women have been allowed to box under the Olympic banner. And what an expensive banner it is. The International Boxing Association says the women could observe religious dress requirements, providing their faces are uncovered, so the judges could record the number of punches they receive. The Afghan team is being sponsored by Oxfam as part of a project designed to promote peace and women's rights. In a country ravaged by 30 years of war and run by a conservative male-dominated society, these female boxers are Afghans' most improbable ambassadors for peace, Oxfam says. Mirway Wardak, who runs the Kabul boxing program, says the team is challenging stereotypes in Afghanistan about how women should behave.
I punch you so hard.
But it's not just Afghanistan, ladies and gentlemen. Other Muslim nations are considering sending female boxers. Egypt has established a women's boxing team, although only some of them fight wearing hijabs. And an Iranian MP says his country would begin training a women's team as soon as suitable clothing could be found. The Olympics. It's a movement. And everybody needs one. And, of course, you know by now that President Obama went to Copenhagen. He's going back to Copenhagen, by the way, you know. Or maybe there's a big, big climate change conference in Copenhagen coming up in December. Be interesting if he doesn't go to that. But anyway, he went to Copenhagen this week to make a pitch, along with his wife, Michelle, for the Olympics to come to Chicago. And you don't have to be a conservative, Obama-hating Republican to think Chicago dodged a bullet, looking at the way the Olympic budget in London has, what, doubled, tripled? Anybody want quadrupled? I'll take quadrupled since it was announced. But, you know, it's, anyway, he went, he came back, he didn't get the Olympics. Not as well known was the announcement this week that President Obama has finally announced he's going to New Orleans, I think, in the next few days. The press release from the White House stressed, well, actually didn't stress, the only thing that it mentioned on his agenda is to discuss disaster preparedness and relief and to improve both of those. Nothing about whether the federal government has any role in preventing the next disaster in New Orleans, which is being built right now by the Army Corps. No, you know, they're doing fine. They're doing whatever they can, aren't they? But anyway, President gone from Copenhagen on his way to New Orleans. In other words,
a few hours in Copenhagen. The right way to pronounce the name. Made my pitch for the Olympics. Had some trouble with my aim. You know, I don't mind not winning. We were never even in the game. You know, didn't need the aggravation. Didn't need to earn a loss. Could have worked the phones on healthcare. Or shouldered my Afghani cross. But Mayor Daley pushed my buttons to where I come from. He's the boss. Yes, he is. So what now? Now I'm going to New Orleans.
It's not too late to care.
Not too late to care.
I'll brag on the new FEMA. Eat some food beyond compare. Yes, I will. See some devastated houses. Should we have tried to have the Olympics there? Good question. You know, I don't mind the competition, but I could have used some clothes, as I could. You don't line up me and Oprah and set us up to lose. You don't do that. I don't think. I got the Lost in Copenhagen, going to New Orleans Blues. Talking blues? Yes, it is. Yes, I'm going to New Orleans. I won't be the one left down. You know, I'll promise to redeem the promise I made last time I was in town. I'll stand next to that mayor. Do my best not to grin behind the front. That's what I'll do. Am I bitter about Copenhagen? You know, I'll admit I'm kind of sore. My advisors were more divided than they are about the war. But you know, I'll go back to looking forward just about 20 minutes more. You know I will. Right now, I don't mind the competition. But, you know, I could have used some clues. I could have used some clues. If you don't line me up with Oprah, then just set us up to lose. I don't know why you do that. I got the talking Lost in Copenhagen, going to New Orleans blues. They're just the blues.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
Yeah, it started here. Take it from me. Well, you don't have to take it from me. A young Afghan girl died when a box of leaflets dropped by a Royal Air Force aircraft landed on top of her. The collapsible container containing public information leaflets for distribution over Helmand province failed to break apart in the air. The unnamed girl was taken to a civilian hospital, later died from her injuries. The British Ministry of Defense described it as a tragic accident. British forces only found out about the incident after the girl died. The Royal Air Force said it deeply regretted the incident and has launched an investigation into how the box, which could have weighed up to 40 pounds, hit the girl. A spokesman said it is a matter of deep regret that one of the boxes failed to fully open and on landing caused serious injuries to an Afghan child. They're sorry. A retired Los Angeles County prosecutor claimed in a 2008 documentary that he advised the judge to sentence Roman Polanski to prison for having sex with a minor. Now says he lied on film about his role in the case. Can't lie on film. The on-camera statements by David Wells were seized upon by Polanski's defense attorneys. Wells, at the time of the alleged misconduct, was not the assigned prosecutor on the case, claimed in the film that he spoke to Judge Rittenband, the judge in the case, before sentencing and told the judge that Polanski deserved prison time. That was not true, he told the Los Angeles Times during a brief interview. I like to speak of it as an inept statement, but the reality is that it was a lie. He said he made up the story believing the documentary would never be shown in the United States. Well, that's a good reason. That's why I robbed the bank. I was never going to spend the money in this country. He told the Times he regretted making the statements in January, but never said they were untrue. Now, he regrets and reveals. Dateline Camp Pendleton, Marine, has apologized for killing an unarmed Iraqi detainee during the battle to recapture the city of Fallujah. Sergeant Jermaine Nelson told a military judge at Camp Pendleton that he failed the Marines by following his squad leader's order and ignoring his training. He killed an unarmed Iraqi detainee, ladies and gentlemen. Nelson says he gave in to peer pressure by obeying his sergeant. He says he should have left and asked superiors for help. The 28-year-old New Yorker spoke near the end of the sentencing hearing. He could get as much as a year in jail for killing an unarmed Iraqi detainee. But he's sorry. Hearts and minds. A member of the board of the German Bundesbank, Thilo Sarrazin, has apologized for his disparaging remarks about the German capital of Berlin. Hello, Berlin. We're on the air there. I realize that not all the wording in the interview was well chosen, Sarrazin said in a personal statement published by the Bundesbank today. Not too busy to do that, are they? He added his comments were entirely personal. He did not speak on behalf of the Bundesbank. In his interview, Sarrazin said Berlin has too many underclass children, too few intellectuals, and many Arabs and Turks who contribute little to the local economy. I sincerely regret that and apologize, he says. Federal regulators are keeping an eye on TD Bank in Massachusetts. You know what the TD stands for? Toronto Dominion. You figure it out. As its technicians struggle to fix a major computer malfunction that left some customers fuming about delays in recording transactions. The glitches apparently caused some customers to miss bill payment deadlines due to bank computers failing to properly record deposits and other transactions. The officer of the Comptroller of the Currency says it's monitoring the situation. The bank has apologized repeatedly and vowed to refund anyone who gets slapped with late fees. The administration at Notre Dame Academy in Park Hills, Kentucky, has apologized for allowing an MTV crew into its school to film a TV show segment, which was done without knowledge of Bishop or the Diocese of Covington school officials. The diocese would not confirm the show for which the segment was filmed. It was believed to be MTV's 16 and Pregnant. That's the name of a show on MTV, ladies and gentlemen. Just letting you think about that. Think about the culture we live in, where also there's another murder in the reality show world. I don't know if we'll have time to get to that, but they're good people. Anyway, the MTV website describes the show as a one-hour documentary series that offers a unique look into the wide variety of challenges pregnant teens face. It also says there's an optimism among them. Notre Dame is an all-girls Catholic school with roughly 600 students. A statement issued by the diocese said the MTV crew was at Notre Dame on September 25th. The bishop and diocesan officials were not informed until 3 days later. We regret the decision to use the school as a vehicle to assist and promote an MTV program. We do not encourage the students or in our schools to watch it. Notre Dame administrators have asked MTV to pull the segment. MTV officials would not comment. Why should they? They got the footage. Wilmington, North Carolina talk radio host Curtis Wright apologized this week for circulating a letter in May saying that Tom Fetzer, now chairman of the North Carolina Republican Party, is gay. Fetzer released a letter from Wright on Friday that settles a lawsuit Fetzer filed against Wright. No money was paid. I'm pleased with the settlement of this issue and with Mr. Wright's apology. Fetzer said there's never issue of monetary compensation, but instead the preservation of my good name and reputation. At the time the suit was filed, Fetzer argued his heterosexuality was a matter of public record. The Episcopal Bishop of Los Angeles, J. John Bruno, has offered a formal apology to Hindus for centuries-old acts of religious discrimination, including attempts by Christians to convert them. I could start a trend. Toyota Motor President Akio Toyota expressed deep regret Friday over a fatal Lexus car crash that may have been caused by a loose floor mat. In occasionally startling terms, Toyota, the grandson of the automaker's founder, also apologized to all customers who may now harbor doubts about the safety of their vehicles. And, bottom of the barrel, John Gosselin is apologizing to his estranged wife, Kate. Kate, I just want to apologize. You know, I'm sorry. You know, I didn't communicate properly. Let's both mediate this thing out. He also says he plans to apologize to Kate face-to-face. You know I'll be watching. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Now, cast your mind back about a year. Wasn't it about a year ago we were told all these toxic assets the banks had on their books were going to prevent them from ever being able to make loans again because they couldn't be valued. Nobody knew their value. They were dropping like stones. We have to get the toxic assets off their books, hence the Toxic Asset Relief Program, the TARP program, later called the Troubled Asset Relief Program. $700 billion, none of it bought toxic assets. This week, the Treasury Department's long-delayed initiative finally started for about $4.5 billion buying troubled assets.
MBAs. For so long, we raked in bucks and praise, cooking up the stew where you now graze. Troubled assets. Good as gold. That's what everyone was told about the paper crap we sold. Troubled assets. Yeah, they're troubled, like champagne that's underbubbled. For short, we call them toxics. They fell to earth, landed on their coccyx. Bad home loans, not much more than skin and bones, spread worldwide like mobile phones. Troubled assets. Funny paper, fine as gruel and strong as vapor. Triple A rated. One thing it can't do, be evaluated. Who will buy certificates piled to the sky? All we did was shrink the pie. Troubled assets. Troubled assets. Troubled
troubled assets. Troubled, troubled assets.
Okay, you twisted my arm. You can buy it on iTunes on sometime this week. Not this. But this you can probably buy on iTunes. I don't know. That's a good question. Ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe on the Usen 440 cable system in Japan, on the Mighty 104 in Berlin. Around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ The Planet, 7.415 megahertz shortwave. Around the world via the internet on your computer at two different locations, live and archived whenever you want it, harryshearer.com and kcrw.com. Available on your smartphone via stitcher.com. Available as a free download to members at audible.com. And available as a free podcast from kcrw.com. And it'd be just like getting those free iodine pills if you'd agree to join with me then, would you? All righty, thank you very much. The email address for this broadcast and a playlist of the music heard here on, just part of the panoply of stuff, along with some used ticker tape, available at harryshearer.com. A tip of the show chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago, and Hawaii desks. And thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW's Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless.